Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. My guest today is Lisa Miraki. Lisa is a philosophy professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She's presently teaching a seminar entitled Yoga and Philosophy, Unpacking the Understanding that Yoga is Philosophy in Physical Form. And this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Lisa. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, well, you're welcome, Lisa. Well, could you perhaps begin by telling us something about yourself and how you became interested in yoga?
Sure. So I think, I think there are lots of ways to answer that question, but here's sort of at least how I got into yoga. But my research focus is in philosophy of mind, cognitive science, and epistemology.
Yeah.
And my training is almost exclusively from a Western perspective.
Yeah.
And I work primarily on contemporary issues. So my main research interests these days are in cognitive science more generally, but also on artificial intelligence. I also have projects working on rationality and knowledge. So that's what I spend most of my time thinking about and working on. I was in graduate school and had a pretty big burnout about halfway through graduate school. And what I had been doing up until then in order to release my stress and anxiety related to my program was I would take these long runs, but I wasn't doing it in a healthy way. I was just kind of pounding my body in order to be tired enough that I wouldn't feel stressed out or anxious.
Yeah.
And that catches up with you after a period of time, and it caught up with me. And so I had to find something physical to do that would be kinder to my body, at least temporarily. And I started practicing yoga using this online site called Yoga Glow, which has all of these online videos. And it's a great resource, especially for somebody like me who was in, I was in an area of the country where there aren't a lot of yoga studios. And so I started doing these videos at home.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with it. Not just as a physical practice, but as now I'm happy to call it a spiritual practice, although I wasn't back then. But it allowed me to explore my emotions, but also the ways in which I tend to respond to problems through my physical body and mm-hmm. through doing something physical. But the thing that really captured my interest and attention was that what I was practicing were the kinds of things that I do that I would like to do more in my everyday life that have nothing to do with physical practice. And once that really clicked and connected for me, yoga became a very, very much a part of my life. Yoga became a spiritual practice for me when my college roommate died in a car accident. So I was almost finished with graduate school at that time. And my college roommate, Jenny Malin, she was in the backseat of a car and was rear-ended by a drunk driver. Mm-hmm. And she died. And I had been raised atheist. And I didn't understand until that event emotionally why people are drawn to religion, because it was never part of my upbringing or part of my growing up. But when she died, I understood it in a kind of visceral way much more than I ever had before. Not just the set of ideas and beliefs, because I think that's a different issue, yeah. But why you might need ritual to deal with grief.
Yeah.
Why you might need a community to deal with grief. And my yoga practice became my ritual way of dealing with my grief. And I could feel the things that I needed to feel and revisit the issues that I needed to revisit in a way that has helped me heal. And of course, I still miss her very much, but I owe it largely to my yoga practice that I've been able to grieve her.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense to me too as well, Lisa. I remember someone once saying to me the religious sensibility is in many ways, well, can be interpreted as coming to terms with or reconciling oneself with our existential condition, whether that's, you know, birth, sickness, or in this case, dying. But and crucially, not actually positing any final answers. That's something I can feel very comfortable with, as along with these other dimensions, as you mentioned, like ritual and community, and the experiential side as well, which yoga is very much a part of.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you mentioned also that you noticed that yoga helped you, not in the spirit, only perhaps in the spiritual side, but in other aspects of your life. For example, do you feel that it helped you just in general decision making or and how you engage with the world and other people and the planet?
Absolutely. I think it helps me. It helps me make better decisions. It also helps me not just make better decisions, but also to my automatic responses are more in line with my values. And that's something that I think yoga is really wonderful in that it does this. But I think any kind of practice helps us do this. So there's a lot of evidence now, as I'm sure you're aware, that some of the ways in which we react to the world are reflection-based and decision-based, and some are much more automatic, where you just do the thing that you always do that response to that.
System one and system two.
Exactly, right. So the typical terminology for this is system one, system two. I think that can be complicated in various ways, but exactly, right. Yeah. So one thing that I think a practice helps us do, it does help us do the reflective bit, and it does help us figure out what we value and what we think and so on. It's absolutely crucial for that. But I think possibly the even more unique, the thing that yoga actually really helps me do is to put that into practice so that it becomes second nature to me. So that when I see myself responding in the ways that I typically do that I've decided are no longer in line with my values, I can see it, acknowledge it, and practice responding in a way that's more in line. And eventually that becomes, if not second nature, at least much closer.
So are you in effect saying that, like many other embodied practices, that it helps you to respond to your experience rather than to react to it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And one of my yoga teachers uses exactly those words to describe that phenomenon, that what you're looking for is a more integrated response to whatever situation you're facing, as opposed to these sorts of automatic reactions that we all react automatically. But the question is that reaction a reflection on who you are and who you want to be, or is it in some sense out of your control? And so I think one thing I think that contemporary psychology and philosophy would do well to incorporate more is, you know, there's this system one, system two distinction that Daniel Kahneman's recent book, Thinking Fast and Slow, did a wonderful job of making these ideas available to the public. I think we should spend a whole lot more time talking about the extent to which there is, over the long term, interplay between these more automatic processes and these more reflective processes. So I don't think, for example, you know, some people use the metaphor of, say, the elephant and the rider. That's Jonathan Haidt's metaphor.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yoga means to yoke, and what it really means is to integrate. And so the way I see it is that although there are these different kinds of processes, if you look at the long term, there's the potential for having a very integrated psychology.
Yeah. Now, the term integration now is becoming sort of common parlance, certainly in psychology. But just for the lay listener, What do you mean by integration in relation to yoga?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on what you think about the system one, system two distinction, what that distinction amounts to. My view is that it characterizes different kinds of processes in the mind, but not necessarily different systems. So I don't think that either system one or system two form a coherent system that operates largely independently of the other. So I think our psychology in that sense is more integrated than many other people think. But there also is this phenomenon, which I think by now we know pretty clearly, which is that a lot of our reactions, our automatic reactions to things, might be based on certain features and done in certain ways that we wouldn't reflectively endorse. So for example, there's a lot of evidence that people make automatic judgments about people based on the color of their skin or their yeah. gender and so on that they wouldn't reflectively endorse. And so some of that may be out of our capacity to change, but I think a lot of it, a lot of how we react to the world is within our capacity to change over the long term.
Yeah.
You know, maybe tomorrow I can't wake up and completely act differently, but over the long term, I think there is the capacity for change.
Yeah. In relation to experiments, I'm just thinking also, does the actual physical practice itself create good habits? I'm thinking of an experiment when people were questioned about giving to charity. They're more likely to give to it if they're holding a warm cup of coffee in the hand, because apparently the parts of your body, and especially parts of your brain which register compassion, also register warmth. So a lot of the physical side of yoga is to do with balance, for example, and trying to find that balance between not being too rigid but not being too floppy. Do you think that also helps you find a sort of balance in the whole mind-body sense?
Yeah. So I, well, first let me say, I think we are at the very beginnings of really understanding the mind in sophisticated scientific way. And it's a very exciting time to be thinking about this stuff and working on this stuff. I think we are acquiring increasing evidence that the body is not, we are not controllers of our bodies, that we're integrated organisms in a much more coherent way. And so we're going to keep finding these connections.
Yeah.
We're going to keep finding these ways in which we exist sort of in our physicality that applies equally well to these very high level decisions, like whether you give back to charity or not. One issue that I think for me has been especially powerful in my own life, but also makes a lot of sense, I think, intellectually, is yoga has helped me feel what I'm feeling. it helps me feel whether I'm anxious or whether I feel in some sense threatened by a situation. It's going to help me understand how that manifests in my body, where I hold tension, or even just something as simple as where my feet are.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really wonderful, because when someone comes into a yoga class for the first time, often the kinds of instructions that are given for how to move their bodies make no sense, right? They make no sense because you haven't acquired that kind of body awareness.
Yeah.
And it takes time and practice to begin to acquire that. But once you do, once you acquire a kind of body awareness, but also a kind of emotion awareness and a breath awareness, that is useful throughout your life.
Yeah.
Because you can, or at least in my experience, I'm more able to recognize, oh, I'm feeling stressed out about this situation. What am I finding stressful?
Yeah.
Can I take a deep breath now and respond to this situation in a way that is more in line with my values? I couldn't even start that conversation with myself if I didn't recognize that I was feeling anxious or stressed out.
Yeah. So that's the it's the starting point in many ways. That's great. Well, I imagine it's also important to recognize that practice is very much an incremental process, that we're indeed very much capable of change, but it rarely happens overnight. Not saying it can't.
Yeah, and when it does happen overnight, it's built on years often of practice. So, for example, headstand for me, tripod headstand is a pose where I had been working on it and practicing for years. And then more or less one day, my legs just went up. and it's a really wonderful experience to have something that you worked so long for, and it's not like you do anything different, but suddenly it clicks and it goes together in the right kind of way. And so, but I think just like you said, it's very important to note that even though the transition happens pretty rapidly, you were working towards it the whole time.
In popular culture, yoga tends to be associated with lightness and flexibility. How can this, you know, we've been talked about integration, how does this become more balanced with also what is dark and perhaps more rigid in our minds and bodies?
Good. Yeah, I think that's a really wonderful, interesting question. So just in terms of the physical body first, I think that there is this perception that yoga is all about flexibility. So often when people hear that I'm a avid yoga practitioner and yoga teacher, they'll say, oh, I can't do yoga, I'm not flexible enough. And one becomes flexible by doing yoga. One doesn't have to be flexible in order to start. But also, it's really not as much about flexibility as people think. So the way I think about a yoga practice is it's about meeting yourself where you are in that moment without judgment and trying to figure out what is an appropriate way of moving my body more towards wholeness and healing and integration for me right now today. And tomorrow it may be different. And today may be different than yesterday, but what is appropriate for my body? And some people need flexibility in our society where people spend a lot of time sitting. For example, working on flexibility is important, but almost always it's equally important to develop strength. So one thing that a lot of people in my yoga community talk about is that the parts of you that are stronger tend to overcompensate for the parts of you that are weaker.
Interesting.
And you see this in the physical body, for example. So one reason why people have lower back pain is that the glutes, which are a really strong muscle in the body, tend to overwork. And the way in which they tend to overwork tends to crunch the lower back.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that we spend a lot of time working on is internally rotating the thighs and activating the other leg muscles so that the glutes are working less and there's more alignment and balance in the physical body. So when you start to work the other muscles, it feels really new and difficult and, you know, you might be sore and so on, but it's also going to provide you relief and lightness, right? So if you're not feeling lower back pain anymore, you're going to feel lighter and healthier and more happier in your body. So that's one thing is that yoga is often actually about strengthening and stabilizing the parts that are weaker. And that's something in the physical body that we you can work on a yoga mat, but that's absolutely something that translates into our psychology. So what is it that you are good at? And it's not bad to be good at something. It's not bad to be strong, but what is, when are the situations when you are overusing a certain capacity that you have that's not serving you in this moment, in this situation? And how can you practice strengthening the other aspects of you in a way that allows you to respond in a more healthy, apt way for your environment? There's another way to answer the question, which is a lot of people think that yoga is always supposed to make you feel good.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, because if you're becoming more sensitive to your automatic responses or reactions to things, often that's ugly. And often when we recognize that we are not responding and or reacting in the ways that we would otherwise want to, and that it's difficult to change these, a lot of dark, ugly stuff can come up. And it's easy to get frustrated. You've worked on the same thing for years, and here it is again. Like, oh, I thought I had worked on this.
Yeah.
Why have I not learned this lesson yet?
Yeah.
And so I think it's important, at least for me, and I think for a lot of other practitioners, it's important to acknowledge that yoga can be really, really difficult and really, really hard. And that's part of the path. It's part of the work. It's just part of it. You're not always going to feel good all the time. You're working on some of the deepest, hardest questions.
Yeah. I'm quite a regular meditation practitioner as well, and that I relate to that very much, especially, you know, if you go on retreat, it's a bit of a roller coaster, really. But but interesting, you know, it's been interested in what's happening in your experience, whether it's pleasant or not.
Right.
What does the philosophy of yoga have to tell us about the juxtapositions of matter and consciousness, and how might that relate to the practice of yoga?
Good. So I think one thing that I took care to do in the course that I taught last semester was to show my students how your views about the fundamental makeup of the world might affect various other beliefs that you have that might at first look unrelated, right? So your belief about what's fundamental or what's real might influence your belief about what a good life looks like. And I think that's definitely part of the yoga tradition and part of many both religious and philosophical traditions, is what is the world really like, and what does that tell us about who we are and what it takes for us to live a good life? I am an atheist. I am also a physicalist, which means that I think the world, more or less as described by physics, right, the world that physics departments are trying to describe, is the fundamental level of reality. I think that the world bottoms out in the physical world, but all of the rest of the complexity of the world and of life is grounded in that fundamental physical reality. And it can look quite different. So, you know, biological organisms are and behave nothing like the fundamental physical particles or other kinds. I think that for me, coming from that kind of worldview, there's an interesting question. Okay, what place does the mind have in the world?
Mm-hmm.
What place do embodied minded creatures like me have in the world?
Yeah.
And that's a question that I hope to spend the rest of my life working on. I think that is, if not the question, one of the central questions.
Yeah.
So I'm very much committed to the idea that although the mind is grounded in the physical world, and so is in some sense nothing over and above it or apart from it, that creatures with minds have very distinctive properties and qualities. And in particular, beings like us, we do have the capacity for reflection. We do have the capacity for culture and for cultivating practices mindfully in this kind of way. And that provides us with, I think, the opportunity to really create ourselves. And that opens up both new possibilities, but also it gives us certain responsibilities that we have the capacity to think about these things, but along with that comes with the responsibility to use it well and use it wisely.
Yeah.
So that's the approach that I come at it, this topic with, which is different from any one particular school, of philosophy. I think that's part of why I'm a contemporary philosopher, is that I feel like at least the position that I want to take up hasn't really been articulated yet.
Okay, yeah. That sort of brings me to my next question. Why do you think physical practice is largely missing from Western philosophies?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think, so I'm not a historian of philosophy,
yeah.
But let me first say that it's there in some of the ancient Greek, philosophy. And
it didn't start off like that. You know, if you think of Stoicism and Epicureanism and especially Pyrrhonism, they were very much focused on practice.
Exactly, exactly. And also, for me, Aristotle is somebody who whose work I think is still very, very much relevant to the way that I think about things. And for him, practice is central. How do you become a good person? You practice doing the things that the good person does.
Yeah,
that's how you become a good person for Aristotle. And I think for various reasons, we've lost that. I think partially in most recent philosophical history, I think philosophy has been modeling itself more on the sciences, especially philosophy of mind has been modeling itself more on the sciences, and has been trying to distinguish what are called descriptive questions about how the world is, how the mind works, from normative questions. What should I do? How should I reason? What should I believe? What is a good life? And I think that these two kinds of questions are much more closely related than at least people traditionally thought. So it's part of my research project to show that you can't explain what it is to have a belief unless you explain what it is to have knowledge. That it's not that you first explain the descriptive thing. What is it for someone to be committed to how the world is? You can't explain first that and then figure out whether or not they're believing in accordance with the world. You have to explain what it is for someone to get onto the facts. And then you can explain how we go wrong in various ways. But I don't think that there's this purely descriptive level of our psychology that's completely independent from the normative level. So I think what it is to believe and how we should believe are tied together in an inextricable way.
Arguably, contemporary yoga teaching often lacks reference to the centuries-old traditional teachings, particularly the spiritual teachings that the practice is rooted in. How can these two be integrated in order to find a balance between nurturing oneself with traditional teachings and also being in the modern world?
Yeah, yoga communities are grappling with this question now in a way I think we haven't. We weren't even doing maybe a decade ago or so. I think this is one of the most pressing questions in our communities now, and in part because we've realized that perhaps unwittingly in the U.S., yoga had become predominantly white, predominantly female, predominantly affluent, and there's no reason it should be that way. There's a lot of reason it should be the reverse of that it should be something that's widely accessible, that's available to you regardless of your skin color, regardless of your gender. And so there's a question about what are the ways in which yoga is being commodified or transformed into something that maybe reinforces the more negative elements of our culture, and how can we move away from that? There's also the question of, when does something count as cultural appropriation? So when there's a statue of Nataraj at the front of the yoga classroom, when is that appropriate? When is it perhaps treated as decoration rather than something more meaningful? Even if you don't believe in some of the more religious aspects that yoga is based on, are there still ways to incorporate these cultural and historical elements in a responsible way? I think there is no right way to do this. I think there are lots of wrong ways to try to make sense of this, but I also think there are lots of ways one could try to incorporate this. So I think for me, the first thing is, people should know where yoga comes from. Mm-hmm. And it's not a history that I want to glorify. So for example, women were not allowed to practice yoga for the longest time.
Yeah.
I think there is no pristine original yoga practice that we should be trying to emulate or that we should try to go back to. It's a complex and messy history,
yeah.
Just like pretty much all of our histories. But I think it's important for us to know that and to think about it. I do think that yoga is always much more than an exercise class. And so when it becomes that, I think we've lost what is most interesting and, in my view, helpful about yoga. So for me, it's always got to be a mind-body practice. It's always got to be about this bigger question, how do I live my life in a better way? And so I think for some people, teaching yoga by talking about the history and talking about the mythology is a good way for them to do that. I think for other people, that's less helpful. They connect less strongly to that, but there are other ways to do it. And there are also ways to integrate yoga into contemporary culture in ways that are really valuable and productive. So I have one friend and fellow teacher in Philadelphia who does this monthly workshop called Namaste. And it's a play on namaste, of course, yeah. Which can translate in many different ways. But one of the sort of central translations is the divine in me bows to the divine in you, or the translation I prefer, the good in me bows to the good in you.
Yeah.
So it's a play on that. And, you know, the colloquial term slaying, where you kind of kill the situation, but in a good way. And she's Black and plays hip hop music mainly, and teaches a very spiritual alignment based yoga class, integrating aspects of Black culture. Of course, there isn't one Black culture, but integrating aspects of that together to show how yoga can be part of our everyday life in exactly the way that it's relevant to our current lives.
Yeah.
And there are many different ways to explore that. And one of the things that I think is most beautiful about the way she does it is that, you know, she says, I didn't know Black people did yoga for a while. And, you know, and I think that she's really hitting on a nerve that a lot of us are needing to confront right now, is that yoga has become so gendered and so racialized and targeted towards affluent people. And if we're going to change that, one of the things we need to do is reassess what we think a spiritual yoga class looks like, or what it looks like to be doing yoga in a responsible way. And what Adriana is doing is very different from some of the other, you know, sometimes you see people perhaps fetishizing Black culture or something like that. You know, what she's doing is so different from fetishizing or commodifying either traditional yoga culture or contemporary Black culture. What she's doing is she's bringing together these aspects of her identity and her way of experiencing and moving through the world in a way that is resonating with other people who otherwise might not be drawn to a yoga class. And she's using the platform that she has to support, for example, there's a melanin and yoga community in Philadelphia that she's been partnering with. And so that doesn't look too much like a traditional yoga class, but it absolutely is, in my view.
Yeah. And then, say, for example, someone who's interested in the idea of yoga, but then is skeptical about a certain aspect. Take, for example, chakras or something. So yeah. You're saying in many ways that they can just come in and cherry pick and find what's useful within the practice.
I think so. I think a cherry picking, a sort of reflective cherry picking is a fine way to do it. So, you know, I'll be honest, sometimes I'll be in a yoga class and people will be saying things that I very strongly disagree with. And I don't think that means that I shouldn't be there or that yoga isn't good for me, but that I don't have to believe everything and I don't have to resonate with everything. I think, though, that things like chakras, I think chakras are super interesting because we can ask the question, do chakras exist? Yeah. Right? And there's one answer I might want to give that says, of course not. Of course they don't exist. When you go to the doctor, do they tell you your chakras are out of balance? And no, they don't. But there's actually some evidence that where we experience certain emotions roughly lines up with where the chakras are and what they're associated with. And so I think that's really powerful. And that's something that I think we're going to keep finding more and more of, that if we think about a lot of these aspects of yoga practices more generally as ways of experiencing our bodies, as opposed to a fundamental makeup of our bodies, that there's a whole lot that's helpful and useful and important and correct.
Yeah.
And so I think I would encourage, yes, you know, figure out what you agree with and don't take on what you don't. But also I would encourage people to stay open-minded about it, because a lot of this, I think, is a really, really deep and important ways of understanding our bodies and how we feel emotions in our bodies.
Yeah. That relates to my experience in the sense that, well, I'm not a yoga practitioner, Lisa, but I am a Tai Chi practitioner. And I've been doing it for several years now, and I find it of enormous value. And there are certain things that I'm skeptical about or agnostic about, but I'm also, over the years, become more curious. And I say there's a lot of parallels between Tai Chi and yoga. One of the interesting things is that I mentioned that I'm a meditator as well, but I'm often better at being mindful doing Tai Chi, because if I'm not, it just all goes to pot. You know, you have to be aware. Yeah. Anyway, my last question: the chair of our society, the philosopher Robert Ellis, has created middle way philosophy, which has taken the middle way and interpreted it in very much from a Western philosophical perspective. However, practice in this is key, starting off very much with embodied practices, which we've been talking about. So just out of interest, what is your understanding of the middle way, if any, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I think this kind of concept of a middle way shows up over and over again in different traditions, in different over different periods of human history. And I think, so for example, it shows up also in Aristotle. So Aristotle thought that
the golden mean.
Exactly, right. the virtue occurs at the mean. And one way of thinking about that is that it's possible to overdo the things that are good for you.
Yeah.
It's possible to over-exercise, to overly restrict yourself in certain ways, where some discipline, some restriction is crucial, I think, to living a good life. But it's possible to overdo it in a way that's no longer serving you or serving those around you. And so I think what's so interesting for me about practice is that I'm really engaging with that question in a physical form every day. So what kind of exertion is the correct amount for me today? What kind of pushing myself is correct, is best for me today? When am I overdoing it? When am I underdoing it? And I think thinking about living a good life in this kind of way, in terms of figuring out what is right for me in this moment, and figuring out how I can best proceed along the path, not overdoing it, not underdoing it, that I think helps to counter a common perception in contemporary U.S. culture, especially at a place like UPenn, which is lots of smart, very ambitious people. And, you know, I was one of these undergraduates, too. So I was exactly the same way. And to some extent, I still am, where there's this idea that nothing is ever good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, that you always need to work harder. You always need to pick up one more activity. You always need to, you need to be thinner. You need to be stronger. You need to be smarter. You need to have read more. And there's this idea that you're not enough the way you are. You always have to work to be better. And of course, we should always be working on ourselves, but there's something about having perfection as a goal that I think is really, can be really harmful and detrimental.
That just reminds me of the expression, the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Exactly. Exactly. And I repeat that to myself several times a semester and to my students too. Yeah. Because often, especially in the kinds of academic circles that I'm in and that I teach in, perfection is not only something to strive for, but if you don't achieve it, you're a failure. Mm. And I think that that's very harmful psychologically to a lot of us. I know that it's something that I am continuously grappling with, trying to reframe my expectations about my own work. But it's also, there is no such thing as perfection, right? There is no such thing as the perfect student or the perfect teacher or the perfect researcher. For me, I find it much more productive to say, okay, what do I have to offer? And how can I be present and give what I can in my work life without letting that interfere or prevent me from having these other things that are really important to my well-being, like having and cultivating good relationships and, you know, exercising and sleeping and eating well and doing all of those things. And how do I find some kind of balance that feels whole and productive and correct? And that might change from time to time. So sometimes I dive into my research and other things need to sit on the back burner for a little while. Sometimes then, though, I try to do the same thing with my personal relationships. Yeah. I don't see balance as a kind of fixed thing. I see it as a constantly dynamic, changing process, something that I'm reevaluating from day to day.
Yeah. Well, that's a great interpretation of the middle way, Lisa. Well, on that note, thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating interpretation of yoga. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about middle way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.